Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. You are listening to the Next Best Picture podcast, and this is my interview with the co-screenwriter for the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, Arash Amel.
Gus March Phillips, I have a mission I want you to lead. Thank you, Sergeant.
What's the plan?
To neutralize the German U-boats in the North Atlantic.
We're losing the war.
Hitler is not playing by the rules, so neither are we.
We both know that I'm not very popular with the administration.
The reason they find you unattractive is the very reason I find you attractive.
If I'm to do this, I'll need my own team. You won't like them. They're all...
No!
Mad.
They'll need to be.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Next Best Picture podcast, where I am being joined right now by Arash Amel, the writer of the new film directed by Guy Ritchie, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. It's quite a mouthful, but believe me, when you see the movie, you'll understand why. Arash, first of all, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, Matt. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you very much for being here to talk about this movie. I saw this just the other day, and I had so much fun with this movie. And normally that's the case when I go into a Guy Ritchie film. Like, I know what to expect with his style at this point. But at the same time, I think with this one in particular, what was most surprising to me was that I thought that this was all original and made up. I had no idea that these people actually existed. So when you wrote this, did you write it to be a different type of film and then Guy Ritchie came along and made it into a Guy Ritchie movie? Or did you write it with the feeling of, hey, I want someone like a Tarantino or a Guy Ritchie or somebody to come along and make this a blast?
In the worst Hollywood way, when I got involved in this project in 2017, the book was sent to me by Jerry Bruckheimer, trying to figure out, look, how do we make this into a movie? Mm-hmm. When I read it, the pitch, and I'll explain how it ended up there, but the pitch that I gave the studio was, this is The Dirty Dozen meets Ocean's 11, directed by Guy Ritchie.
There you go.
That was the, and the reason why that was the case was that I read this book and the Damian Lewis's historical nonfiction book that is the basis of the movie, and which itself is the basis of these sort of declassified War Department files. Mm-hmm. And within it, I saw this absurdity, this ridiculousness of these kind of like misfits being put together to go and fight the most crippled, the most mechanized, advanced army that history has ever seen, and sort of, you know, the sort of the blitzkrieg of the Nazis. And it immediately sort of transported me back to the great war movies that I grew up with, and not the sort of the ones of the 60s and 70s that, you know, that really influenced me, which weren't serious, which weren't the kind of, there was long enough from the end of the war that pop culture had started to claim the war and sort of reinterpret it. So, you know, the works of John Sturges, The Great Escape, the Westerns that influenced that, The Magnificent Seven, The Dirty Dozen, as I've said, Kelly's Heroes, Where Eagles Dare. It goes on and on and on. So, you know, it's this blend of those 70s war movies and the spaghetti Westerns. So within that milieu, I was like, I want to see that movie. I want to see that movie. I want to have a good time. The lessons of that war are in danger of being forgotten. Nazism is still here. It's not gone away. Here was a story that was this global coalition of different cultures and nationalities and people from all walks of life coming together to defeat Nazis. And who doesn't like that?
I was going to say, in the sense of like, and I don't mean this as a knock necessarily, mm-hmm. this film doesn't need to necessarily be multi-layers deep in its messaging. It's very, very simple. When you watch the movie, it makes its point across in the bloodiest, most fun manner possible. And sometimes that's all you need, is to be reminded, hey, you know what? Movies can be fun and fuck Nazis.
I love that. That should be our new tagline.
Right?
Fuck Nazis. Yes, because I feel that we're in danger in this era for cinema where it is sequels and prequels and reboots and, you know, and sort of an IP and so on, is that original cinema has kind of been booted off into this left field of, you know, seriousness and you know, prestige, not to knock any of that. Like,
sure.
But the movies that you would just go, it's an original movie based on something that may or may not have happened. And in our case, it did happen. But it's something that I go to and I have fun mm-hmm. and I enjoy myself. And it was really, for me, it was this forgotten genre of movie that was an opportunity for us to bring it back. And it's no coincidence that Jerry was the producer. I mean, this is the producer of the Pirates of the Caribbean and right. Armageddon. And, you know, you go back, The Rock, and you keep going back. It's a Con Air. Like, it is meant to be a good time. And that was why, from the beginning, my dream scenario was the guy would direct it, because that swagger, that kind of, you know, fuck those Nazis and let's go kill them. I mean, there's only...
Yep.
Do that. I mean, he's a genre unto himself. So that was it.
And it's interesting too, when I watch the movie, it does have the feeling that, oh, this could be laying the groundwork for more missions, and there is a sequel down the line. But you're limited to history. These are based on real characters. What are you going to do? Just like make stuff up that didn't happen necessarily? So it could go either way here.
So first, to be clear, that the number 62 commando unit, which is what this unit was officially called, the small scale raiding force, operated all the way to 1945. So this was only, and if you look at Damien's book, they ran for the whole of the war. They had some crazy missions. And in fact, some of those other missions are actually being ported into the movie. And I'll give you one example.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the opening sequence where I'm not going to spoil it for anybody, but you've seen it in the trailer. They go in, they sneak into a Nazi camp, and they kill a bunch of Nazis, and they, you know, trying to rescue their colleague, you know, Apple, yeah. Alex Bechdel. That was actually based on a second operation that they did. So this operation was around January 42. They actually did it September 42, which was to raid a Nazi base, a compound with a garrison in the Channel Islands. To steal naval intelligence. And as all the details were exactly the same. They you know, went up to these cliffs in this little boat they called the Little Pisser, and they climbed this cliff and they cut the, you know, wires. And in that scenario, it was even more ridiculous, because the Nazis, actually, a couple of them fainted on the sight of seeing them. You know, some of them ran away. Some of them had hair nets on and were in the shower. So they really caught them by surprise. And so I was like, let's amalgamate that with the, you know, there were subsequent missions that they really did raid and murder and mayhem. So there were so many adventures that these guys went on. If I had the opportunity, if the audiences sort of created the opportunity for us to tell a subsequent story, there's plenty of mileage in history.
So did you write this to be a one-off, or did you write this with that open door?
I wrote it in the hope that people would love to see further adventures. And I know Joey has been on record to say I would, if he had his way, he would jump at doing another movie. So, you know, but I'm always nervous about putting the cart before the horse. Well, you know, you always put it out there in the hope and why not? I mean, if people want to see more Nazis being sort of multiple murder of Nazis, then who am I not to oblige?
Well, I gotta say, I love this group of characters here, and I think everybody just has such fantastic chemistry with each other, and the movie's just so slick, so clever. I was curious to know, how did you decide, because there are so many characters, how did you decide which perspectives to focus in on the most? Because from my point of view, you know, a lot of attention is given to Marjorie and Gus March Phillips. You know, I think those are the two who probably have, I think, the most screen time in the movie. So how did you decide that I'm going to base my narrative structure from the perspectives mostly of these two?
The real life mission was actually two components. There was the guys on a boat that went down. And if you're interested at all, it was actually Alex Pettifer was never on the boat with them. He actually went on a separate ship just to do some research and see where the actual ships were. And sort of, but so that was that component. Mm-hmm. Then there was a ground component, which was actually run by, in real life, a character called Richard Lippitt, who was an SOE spy, together with local African Nigerian spies who were in and on Fernando Po. And Marjorie actually didn't physically go on the mission. Marjorie was running that component for M, Annie, and Fleming from home base. And when I came to the adaptation, I looked at Marjorie's character, and I was very much of the thought that, firstly, Marjorie was the most incredible person in real life. She was an actress. She has an IMDb list of credits. Yep. She trained female operatives to go behind enemy lines in France. So she was, you know, she was a trained paratrooper, so she would jump out of planes and stuff. And so she did all of that. I was like, my God, this woman is a badass. I want to see her there. And that's one point I think that, you know, you can make a leap with history. So what I did was that it was always going to be two components of the mission on screen. You were going to see Gus and his men and that on the boat. And you were going to see Marjorie and the composite character that Richard Herron became, which who Babs plays, who's one of my favorite characters in the movie as the spy. He became a composite of the real life Richard Lippitt and the African spies that were there. And so you would see this kind of two halves of an operation at the same time that all eventually come together for this big, big finale. And so this back and forth with M and Ian Fleming sitting in the middle, if you kind of look at it sort of in that way, and at some point being told to fuck off by Gus and his team, which, you know, a lot of that again was drawn from truth as well.
I'm sure.
To all of our listeners of the Next Best Picture podcast, we know you love movies. We do too. Do you like going to the theater? Well, Regal Unlimited just makes sense. Regal Unlimited is the all-you-can-watch movie subscription pass that pays for itself in just two visits. See any standard 2D movie anytime with no blackout dates or restrictions. When you want to watch a movie in a premium format like 4DX, IMAX, RPX, or ScreenX, your Regal Unlimited membership gets you into those premium experiences at a reduced cost. And with Regal Unlimited, you won't just save money on tickets, you'll also save on snacks. Members get 10% off on all non-alcoholic concession items. So if you're planning to see two movies this month, just two, you need to join Regal Unlimited. Sign up now in the Regal app or on regmovies.com/unlimited. That's regmovies.com/limited. And you can tell them Next Best Picture sent you with the promo code /RegalNBP24. That's /RegalNBP24.
Man, it's so funny, like, how much just creative liberty, like, you could be given with something like this to have fun with it. And I think that extends mostly to the cast too, because I just get such a sense of how much they're enjoying speaking this dialogue to each other. It's done in a way that's so suave, so cool. And I'm curious to know, was it mostly verbatim, or did the actors take your words and kind of twist them a little bit? Because what's up on the screen is fantastic, but I'm just curious how that translated once it got in the actors' hands.
Well, with a movie like this, where you have so many moving parts, there's so much. And also, once it goes to Guy has a very unique style of working in terms of actually looking at the actors and saying, what can you do? What do you like doing? What is your skill? What is your technique? Take an example. You know, there was no, Isa was never supposed to sing. There was no singing in the original script, right? But Isa can sing, and Guy was like, oh, sing. So let's put a song in there. Let's have you doing a song. And then what if that song was in German? Let's have you sing it in German. It's like, well, I can't speak German. Oh, well, that doesn't matter. Let's, you know, so, you know, with a movie like this, it's where it's a lot less sort of, it's a lot more to do with the feeling and the actors actually inhabiting the roles. Mm-hmm. My job was actually to create such a solid structure of character that they could then go on and they could, you know, bring their own twist to it, because I feel that's why they work, because, you know, Guy allows the actors to kind of to bring that sort of, you know, the joy of inhabiting the clothes of this character and really running with it. As you, and I think that's where I'm, you know, you see, you know, in Henry's performance, for example, like, you know, how much he's truly enjoying it. So it's very much an entire collaborative process. And I think with movies of this type, if you try to hold and you try to control and you try to be too rigid with what the text is and what's being said, rather than the essence of being what's being said. And look, can we use sort of, you know, these words to convey the same meaning as those words? Let's do it. Like, it's not, you know, it's as long as we're all moving towards the same target and we're trying to all make the same fun and suave and sophisticated movie.
Right, right. What was the hardest scene to write?
Oh my God, the hardest scene to write. It was actually the hardest sequence to write.
Okay.
Was the, I don't want to give the ending away, but the hardest sequence was technically trying to balance the tension between what was happening in the party.
Yes.
What was happening in the boats. You have, if you think about it, you have two tugboats coming in, three ships, a party happening at the same time. And what I'm very happy with is that that was actually constructed very early on. That was one of the sections of the movie that just didn't change all the way through. And obviously there was some, you know, concessions made for production and so on, all those things. But the trying to sort of maintain the tension while making sure no one gets confused. And I hope you were very clear as to, you know, who was stealing what and what was the ticking clock and what was happening. So that whole sequence was the part that I was most nervous about, because really the whole movie's building up to that, and the engineering of that had to be right. And often, you know, that's the forgotten and unspoken components of screenwriting. Like, it's not just the dialogue or the words on the page or the characterization. It's actually construction of, hey, do these 30 minutes of action actually make sense? And, you know, if we're cutting between, you know, five different scenes, and you see it in the end of Nolan movies, like where it's just the intercutting, it's a lot of writing to get to that, you know, even before you shoot a frame. So that part of it was my sort of sleepless nights.
I think about that a lot in terms of how you're basically already editing before an editor or anybody ever comes along. Like, you're like, you know, pre-editing the film when you're writing it, essentially. And I think that construction is something that a lot of people don't tend to think about, especially when it comes to intercutting. I think people think scenes just are sometimes written out from beginning to end, and then it finds itself later in editing. And it's like, no, writers have to think about how this is all going to work, essentially. You kind of have to play it out in your own mind, if you will. So all that really does make a lot of sense to me. As we get to the end here, you have such a varied filmography, from sports films and war films and action films, and, you know, you've had your hand in a lot of different projects. I'm curious to know, what is both, would you say, your comfort zone? And what is maybe, say, an unknown area that you're like, I've never done that before, but that seems like a very unique challenge that I would want to take a crack at?
I have never done horror before. I don't know why. I think maybe I just don't enjoy the feeling of making myself scared. You know, I prefer to sort of, you know, laugh. So there's, you know, that's one area. But it's interesting because I asked that of myself, and, you know, over the years, there is a common trend through most of the movies, is that typically they're always about misfits or outsiders. There's somebody who, you know, Marie Colvin, who was kind of kind of complete outsider. Giannis, who in basketball kind of was an outsider, who now is, you know, very much the face of the NBA. And again, our misfits in the small scale raiding force, who were the epitome of like the misfits. And often it's the, you know, they're going against the system. They're going against, up against, you know, really great odds. And somehow I ended up gravitating towards that. And I looked at it and thought, oh, okay, there is this sort of DNA that kind of runs through it. So for me, it's also an exploration of cinema, because I remember being, you know, a teenager and seeing Schindler's List and Jurassic Park at the same, you know, in the same year from the same director. And it made me think that, wow, like you really can tell stories that are in completely different genres and different styles, but as long as they speak to you in a way that you understand, like, you know, areas of cinema that you want to play with. And, you know, and I grew up, I was raised by cinema. So I was raised by theater and VHS. And,
yeah,
you know, I used to live in a video store from the age of 10, 11, 12. I'd go and just see as much as I can. And so I feel sort of that somehow has created this sort of need that, you know, I would love to do, for example, a movie like Sneakers. Do you remember Sneakers?
Yeah, totally. Almost
like I watched that again recently. First time I saw it was when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a reminder of, again, like how cinema used to sort of move you and but entertain you and take you to places. And so that's kind of what I am exploring. It's kind of going into places that I don't know and being surprised. So that's kind of the underpinning of it very much.
Well, Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is definitely the kind of film that as 10, 11-year-old in a video store, I would have loved to have plucked off the shelves, and I would have rewatched and worn that VHS tape out. That's for sure. But looking at your future here, I see you have some upcoming projects. Are you able to tell us a little bit about where we can find your work in the future?
Yes. So both in film and television, we're currently shooting a TV show based on a comic book that I wrote for Amazon called Butterfly with Daniel Day-Kim. It's a spy thriller set in Korea. And we're very excited about that, hopefully out by the end of the year. And keeping in sort of in line with history, Fred and Ginger, the Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movie with Jamie Bell, which we're working on behind the scenes. And there'll be a few announcements about that in the next couple of months or so. There's some really exciting sort of developments. That
I talked with Jamie about that last year during the All of Us Strangers tour.
Oh, really? Oh, in the next 2-3 months, it'll be something that it's I think will surprise everybody, and we're, you know, it's one of those secrets where you're kind of quietly excited and hope it all sort of holds together. But that's certainly sort of on the near term horizon.
Very cool. Very, very awesome. Well, Arash, thank you so much for your time here today. I really, really appreciate it. I highly urge our listeners to go out and check out the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. There we go. It's a blast. It's a good time. If you like seeing very beautiful men and a beautiful woman just team up together to obliterate Nazis, this is the movie for you. So, Arash, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Matt. Pleasure so much.
Take care.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to my interview with the co-screenwriter from the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, Arash Amel, here on the Next Best Picture podcast. The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is now currently playing in theaters from Lionsgate. You have been listening to the Next Best Picture podcast. We are proud to be part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, and you can subscribe to us anywhere where you subscribe to podcasts. Be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and let us know what you think of the show. We really appreciate your feedback and your support, which you can also lend on over at Patreon. For $1 minimum a month, you'll get some exclusive podcast content from us. Thank you all so much for listening, as always, and we will see you all next time.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.